The GRT Gaming Podcast, episode 350, recorded on May 14th, 2014.
Welcome to the 350th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 183rd episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
I am Jordan Lund.
And I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and includes gaming history.
So we've hit a sort of a milestone, which is 350. The reason why we didn't have a podcast last week was that the Time Warner cable went down and it didn't want to get up again. And the result...
Don't you hate it when that happens?
And the resulting mess just made it impossible to edit. So this week's news has a ton of news. We have a ton of news this week.
I've got a couple weeks worth of news here.
Well, no, I mean, I deleted some of the old news, you know, like... One was the news about the Uncharted game. Oh, no, that was last week. That was 2 weeks
ago. Yeah.
No, but there was some... that's right. The EA was going to be debuting their Star Wars Battlefront game. Some other minor news. I mean, you know, they were important the week they were done, but they're not so weak. They're not so big this week. There are some news from last week, though, that are still relevant now. And we still have a very large gaming history.
Large history.
One of the important people from games past and present, actually. Okay, well, what have you been playing, Paul?
You know, I've not really been playing anything interesting or too much in depth for the time being.
Has there been anything that you're looking forward to, though?
Is there a new Zelda coming out? Oh, Kingdom Hearts 3.
Yeah, actually, you know what? I started getting pre-orders, pre-order offers for The Sims 4. And that's coming
really?
Out. That's coming out this year. That's coming out sooner than I thought it was. It's sort of like sneaking up on me. And I'm actually toying with getting the most expensive edition, which comes it has its own season pass for content. So, you know, The Sims 4 never had a subscription thing for content. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. If all they do is just add a bunch of clothes and furniture, I'll be disappointed. But if they add an actual, you know, like they include a minor expansion, you know, that like adds pets or something like that, then it'll be worth it.
Jonah talks about things sneaking up on him and all I hear is the Scooby-Doo music.
I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you pesky kids.
Yeah. So how about you, Jordan?
Well, you know, I can't remember if I've said this or not because we've made a couple of failed attempts at recording this podcast, but I downloaded the demo of Child of Light and played through the entire demo.
Right.
It's absolutely a drop-dead gorgeous game, but there's really not a lot of substance to it. I mean, it also is really, really floaty. When you jump once, you can fly around the entire screen and it doesn't really feel like a platformer or a game. I'm really not quite sure what the point of Child of Light is. I'm not sure about spending $15 on it, but maybe, you know, if it ends up being discounted or maybe Sony will let my personal information get stolen again and I can get it for free. I don't know. But it is absolutely a drop dead gorgeous game. And the way her hair moves when you turn around is fantastic. It's just that there's not,
huh? She ages when she levels up.
I think I leveled up once or twice. I didn't really notice it at the time.
Really? I thought you how much of it? I thought you said you played through it, or you just said you played it.
I played the demo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. For understand, the game is sort of on the short side, and it's not very substantive, you know. So the impressions that you're getting from the demo are basically what you can expect from the actual game. This isn't the situation. Like when you play a demo and it's nothing like the actual game and it's like you hear that the game is actually better than the demo. And I know your complaint, Jordan, is why didn't you make the demo better so I could buy the actual game?
Well, exactly. My problem with bad demos is that this is what the marketing department wants you to see. if this is what they want you to see and it's not any good, what does that say about the rest of the product?
But you know what? At least they released a demo, because
at least they released a demo. That's true. And not everybody's doing demos these days.
And they released an accurate demo. So you have that as well. So, you know, the impression that you got from the demo is your actual impression. I've found myself playing a lot of Lords of Waterdeep on my iPad. I mean, it's funny. It's one of those board games in which now I don't want to play other humans. I cannot stand playing humans, that board game. But I will play it against computer opponents on my iPad.
Interesting.
I don't know. It's just one of those games in which I get irritated with other people when I play. But at least
I think you get irritated with other people on a general basis, though,
no,
don't you?
No. I mean,
you wouldn't know it from the podcast.
Waka waka.
The other game that they started doing pre-orders for was Dragon Age Inquisition as well, and that I have to get the major digital download deluxe for, because I want all the content. I don't have to buy it piecemeal like I did with Dragon Age 2. So, and that I'm really, really looking forward to. I just started playing today, on the day of this podcast recording, The Walking Dead Season 2, Episode 3. Jeez, that's a mouthful, isn't it? The series just keeps getting darker and darker and darker. It's making the comics look like sunshine and rainbows. You know, it is just, I think part of it is that you're actually involved and you're actually doing this stuff. So it's sort of, you know, at least when you're reading the comic, it's more passive, right? But when you're actually having to do it, it's like, oh, why? Why do I have to make that choice? You know, that sort of thing. I'm actually finding myself enjoying the Wolf Among Us a lot more.
Both of them are very good games, and I need to spend more time. I think what I need to do is just wait for all of the seasons to be complete and then sit down and just kind of stomp through them. I played the first episode of Wolf Among Us and then got distracted, and then downloaded the next one or two and just haven't got back to it. And then the same thing with Walking Dead Season 2 is that I purchased the first episode, I bought the season pass, and then forgot about it. Sitting there on my hard drive taunting me.
Speaking of sneaking up on us, you know what comes out in 2 weeks?
Watch Dogs comes out in two weeks, yeah.
You know, it's like, I could have sworn that this game was going to be like a 2015 release, you know? You had that feel, which, and I'm just praying that Ubisoft isn't, instead of taking till 2015, just releasing a cheaper, less complex version of the game that they were promising, because that would be very disappointing.
Well, you know, they did downgrade it a lot after the initial E3 videos, and the second video batch that they came out with was not well received, and now they're talking about a resolution downgrade on both the PS4 and Xbox One versions, which has people up in arms. I've been reading the gaming forums on Reddit, and boy, people are pissed that it's not going to be 1080p, 60 frames per second,
please,
as promised.
I don't care about that. You know what really matters? I care about frame rate. I don't care about resolution, because if you have something that's 560p, I don't care.
Well, and they downgraded it from 60 frames a second to 30 frames per second.
Well, that does matter a little bit, but you know, if that was the sacrifice that they made to keep the graphics in, then that's fine. I mean, the gameplay in, that's fine with me.
We'll see what it does when it comes out. I'll be interested to see how the PC side of it works, because you know as well as I do, when you get into things like Assassin's Creed 4 had so many different driver problems on the PC, it was not even funny. I'll be interested to see how the PC side turns out.
It just makes me wonder about Tom Clancy's The Division, you know, because if they're not able to handle this, then how in the world are they going to be able to handle that?
Well,
system intensive, even if it's an MMO.
I think Watch Dogs is a lot more involved than The Division, right? Where you have every person in the game is basically hackable through their cell phone.
Well, you know, yeah, Microsoft's cloud.
I don't think there's anything quite like that in The Division, though.
It's a lot more complex than you think. But,
But you're not running around being able to hack every NPC in the game, right?
Mm. Well, you know, you can. There's probably going to be an element of randomness to that, you know. I don't think.
I guess, or what they will have is they will have, you know, different classifications of people,
contextual things in which you get a mission and all of a sudden two of the bots out there are assigned a real identity, that sort of thing. But starting off the game news, take it away, Jordan.
Game news, EA rumored to be nearing deal to stream games via Comcast. This comes to us from Games Industry Biz. In a move that would significantly expand EA's potential customer base, the publisher is reportedly close to finalizing a deal with telecom giant Comcast. EA would stream its video games on X1, Comcast's operating system featuring internet applications, viewing recommendations, and voice control. Not only would the deal give EA access to Comcast's 22 million users, but it also would represent a rather big jump into video games for the cable firm. Quote, if the agreement goes through, it would mark the boldest step yet by a cable company to muscle into the territory of leading video game console manufacturers such as Sony Corporation and Microsoft Corporation, Reuters noted in the report. EA and Comcast has been testing out the service, and the aim is to make purchasing video games as easy as ordering a movie on pay-per-view. If the Comcast merger with Time Warner Cable also goes through, it could make this EA partnership even more important.
Yeah, I'm still not high on streaming games. I don't think we're anywhere close to that yet.
Well, and I wonder how it's going to work. I unlike you guys, I am a Comcast customer. X1 is their operating system, but it's only available on some devices. It's not available on all cable boxes. You have to have their, you know, digital starter package with the DVR and all of that stuff to have access to X1. But they are promoting it very heavily. They have, you know, the cast from the Star Trek movies in their commercials talking about how this is the future and all of that stuff. But they also have to explain how the games, A, are going to stream, and B, what are you going to do? Are you going to hook up a mouse and keyboard to your DVR box? I mean, how is this going to work?
Do you even
have
X1? We
don't know that detail yet. I do not have X1 on my cable box. No, it's just the regular Comcast cable box.
I think there are far too many questions, like Jordan was beginning to point out, like, what are you going to do? Connect a mouse to your cable box. Before I can get really excited about it, but it's definitely... I mean, if it goes through, it's definitely going to have lots of repercussions on the space in general. It might be the next, like, iPhone-level disruptive technology.
I don't know. I don't know if I would go that far, because cable companies did do this with Sega back in the 90s, right? There was the Sega Channel, which was a cartridge that plugged into the Sega Genesis. You hooked your cable up to it, and then you could, on a subscription basis, play Sega games over your cable. I don't remember it being that big a deal. I toyed with it, but never really seriously. And I don't really know of anybody else that did it. So, you know,
but I think that you might have just answered the question about why it wasn't such a big deal at the time, though. You know, subscription models as a business right now are really not, you know, in vogue, to put it politely. True. And, you know, if it's going to be on more of like a pay-per-view style basis, it might really take off.
That's true. It could. We'll see.
It's just so early. It just feels like there's a lot of unknowns.
I don't know. I don't see this happening for another 20 years. I mean, for one thing, we don't have the technology yet. I mean, we do not have the saturation of internet across this country, let alone other countries, to actually have this, you know?
So, but we do have cable hardwires.
I guess, but it's still not enough. I mean, it's still not.
If anybody can pull it off, it would be Comcast doing it directly rather than some other third party, like we saw with all the other streaming services that kind of went nowhere.
I wouldn't get too excited about Comcast, because, you know, they're just this close to being ma-billed, you know.
Well, that's true too.
You know,
and the other thing that I find interesting is that, you know, Comcast 22 million users is what they say there, but not all of them are going to have the X1 service. So, you know, how large a base are we actually talking about?
Is Microsoft going to sue them for using the name X1 anyway?
I'm not sure they can.
I was a joke. We're going to move on to our next item, and this item had Paul's ears steaming last week, and it's probably going to be still steaming a little bit this week. Nintendo responds to gay marriage petition, and this comes to us from Kotaku. Nintendo has responded to a fan-made petition that set out to get gay marriage support in the upcoming Nintendo game Tomodachi Life, which allows players to hang out and start relationships in a weird, surreal, alternate universe inhabited. Habitated? Really? Is that a word? Habitated?
Yes.
Okay. By me. Well, the thing is, my spell check says it's not a word. Habitated by me characters. The response has been called by many news outlets, including Kotaku, as quote-unquote tone-deaf. Nintendo stated, Nintendo has never intended to make any form of social commentary with the launch of Tomodachi Life. The relationship options in the game represent a playful alternate world rather than a real-life simulation. We hope all our fans see that Tomodachi Life was intended to be a whimsical and quirky game, and they were not absolutely not trying to provide social commentary. The ability for same-sex relationships to occur in the game was not a part of the original game that launched in Japan, and that the game was made up with the same code that was used to localize it and for other regions outside of Japan. Close quote. Kotaku responded, denying gay people the right to get married in the game about relationships and marriage itself is itself social, quote-unquote, social commentary. Nintendo later told Associated Press, we have heard and thoughtfully considered all the responses. We will continue to listen and think about feedback. Now, that was last week. This week, there's actually an update to that. And they now say that the next version of the 3DS, this game's for the 3DS, by the way, for Tomodachi Life may include it. So, okay, Paul, why don't you tackle this?
Yeah, I think the response that they ultimately landed on is fine, but really, would it have killed them to say that in the first place?
I just wonder.
I mean, just from a production standpoint, there's too much to do there to patch it or to repull the code or to stop it at this phase now. Really, would it have been too difficult for them to, a week ago, just been like, you know what, that's something we didn't think about. We will definitely keep it in mind for the sequel.
I don't know, because the thing is that, A,
it's this whimsical world fantasy crap that they tried to tell me, which pissed
me off. It wouldn't have been difficult to just allow that. I mean
it would have been difficult to change it at this point.
At this point, but they had a couple of months of this, and you know, in which they, you know, and there's, you know, this, the fact they're saying, well, we took those few months to do localization. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because that's how long localization takes. It doesn't make it. There's too much of a financial impact once it has been greenlit for localization to then go back and then restart touching the code base.
I'm just wondering if there's any gay people in Japan. Apparently
well, that
not.
Was my question. Isn't gay marriage a thing in Japan too? I mean, exactly.
You know, I don't know. I think Kotaku is right in that Nintendo is very tone deaf in its response. It just said, "Oh, you know, well, guess what? We're not trying to make a social commentary. Yes, you are. You know, and you don't need it in the game, which has, you know, love and relationships, because the thing about." When you play The Sims, what's the thing that most people do? They create virtual avatars of themselves. You know, they put themselves in The Sims, and they want them.
Idealized avatars.
That's basically the point. But I'm saying is they want them to be able to behave that character behaves. So if you're gay and you're playing The Sims, you're going to make a character that goes with the same sex relationships. You know, and if you're playing Tomodachi Life and you want to do that with your character, you won't be able to do that with your character, which is frustrating. Because then you'll be creating a fake version of yourself that you don't like.
Or a closeted version. That's worse.
Well, having kids and, you know, that's worse than closeted. That's basically denying. Anyways, getting away from the quote-unquote social commentary. I don't know. The thing is about Nintendo may have realized is that The Sims 4 is coming out this year. And it is the 300-pound gorilla in the room when it comes to virtual life. And I don't think anybody's going to even give it a look, second look, you know. I mean, I don't know if Electronic Arts is releasing it for the 3DS. I can quickly check. But I know that, you know, I'm pretty sure Paul over there is probably going to, well, I don't know. Are you going to pick it for the Wii U or for the PC?
Tamagotchi Life? I don't think I'm getting it.
No, I'm talking about The Sims 4. Are you going to be picking it for the Wii U or the PC?
It might need to wait until I get a new PC.
Okay. Well, what if it's for the Wii U?
Possibly, but I think that part of what attracts me to The Sims as a brand is that EA has, since the brand's inception, you know, really felt like just give us our fair due for the game, and then you could do with it whatever you want, which is why they're so strong and always has been so strong of a fan community and user generated content,
right?
Which is what I find appealing about the game. You know, I want to go and find, you know, a pre-made virtual West Hollywood because that's where I live.
I forgot, you know they made a big deal about it being PC only for a while, so I think you have to wait a year for The Sims 4 to come out on console.
Right.
They don't have system requirements yet either. So
my point was
yeah.
My point was that you could you know, you probably still won't be getting that same kind of user generated content on, especially on something like the Nintendo Wii U.
Okay. Well, that's a question for you. How much did you rely on user created content for The Sims 3? Or Sims 2, I did. I remember using The Sims 2 for some of the user created content for that, but not so much for 3.
Well, I mean, it all depends how much control you want to have. What is that noise?
That is, I think that's Jordan's fan. Is that your fan, Jordan? Anyways, go on.
Jordan, even there. To answer your question, I guess it all depends on how much you want to fully customize your idealized avatars. All I know is that I found a lot of the clothes in there boring.
In the game itself.
Yeah, so I found a lot of the stock clothes. I mean, especially it's like the longer that you want to play a game, the more you kind of need that new content.
Well, I think a lot.
And it's kind of unfeasible to expect EA to create, you know, new content every day, where I could really like go every week and find new user generated content.
You know, I think the big
to keep me interested.
The big thing about Sims 4 is it's going to have even more variety in body types, and I think that's the number one thing that people wanted from The Sims 3. Because you had fat and muscular, but they were always the same type of fat and muscular, you know. Now they have a lot more variety in it, you know. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Paul. $300 printer.
$300 3D printer coming early 2015, and this comes to us from Tom's Hardware. With hours still to go in its campaign, remember this was last week, the Micro has raised more than $3.3 million, leaving its original $50,000 goal in the 3D printed dust. Advertised as, quote, the first truly consumer 3D printer, end quote, the Micro appears to be popular, not that just for its humble price, it's also less than a foot in dimension, claims to be one of the quietest 3D printers on the market. This puts the Micro at the forefront of a movement to make 3D printers as common as household appliances as toasters or regular printers. The Micro is far from the best 3D printer on the market in terms of quality. This advertised print resolution is between 50 and 350 microns per layer, which is quite a wide range, for those of you who don't know that. Compare that to the upcoming Cube 3 3D printer by 3D Systems, a slightly larger printer that costs less than $1,000 and claims to print resolution of 75 microns, 200 microns at high speeds. But the Micro does come with all the basics required for a functional at-home 3D printer. It supports standard filament rolls, the spools of plastic that are used to, you know, print into objects. It's also easy to resupply. It can print objects up to 4.6 inches tall and 2.4 inches
no,
by 4.
4.2 inches tall.
Okay,
2.4 fine. Is a big difference there.
All right, so you could basically make a 4x4x4 cube.
Or 4.5. Okay?
Which isn't huge, but it's enough for jewelry and knickknacks. The Micro also comes with 3D printing software for Mac, Windows, or Linux computers, and connects to them via a USB port. The creators, Bathsheba, a Maryland-based company, M3D, say that Micro also comes fully assembled for a, quote, plug-and-play setup. Micro 3D printers ordered via the Kickstarter campaign, which was still open at the time of this article.
Not anymore.
It was a while back. Will be shipped in February 2015, though it's possible to pay more to get an earlier version.
Okay, I know that Jordan here is the most enthused about consumer-level 3D printers.
Yeah, I think it's a very cool idea. I'm waiting for the first real functional 3D printer to be on the market. It's a very nifty idea. I don't know, you know, how long it's going to be before these things explode. I think when you get to a point where somebody not only will do a 3D printer, but do a color 3D printer, it'll be, you know, the no-brainer moment and things will really just start taking off.
You want to impress me? 3D scanner.
That's true. You do need to render your objects in three dimensions. So, you know, that's a part of it as well.
Well, I remember that you were going on about the most important feature of this would be to make parts that are almost impossible to find. you know.
Yeah, for example, there's a part on my shower door that broke. I need to replace it. It's plastic. I can't find it anywhere because apparently you can't just go to a store and buy this shower part, but I could certainly take a model of it and print it on a 3D printer and then I'm done and I don't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah, I kind of can't figure out why I personally would need this, so I'm not really that excited about it.
Action figures.
Yeah, I think
I mean that might be cool. I guess we talked about that before. Like right now Warcraft. I'm collecting the I'm sorry, can I finish a sentence?
Go ahead.
That's the second time. So yeah, right now I'm collecting the current line of He-Man figures, and they're having production problems because, you know, they have to produce X number, so they're running on a subscription basis. I really do think that if, you know, especially with smaller niche lines, that really all they have to do is develop the 3D printing program to sell online, and then whoever wants one, you know, they take on the manufacturing costs.
Oh, hold on.
I think that will happen.
Might be interesting.
We're bearing the lead here. Paul, you're collecting He-Man figures? I mean, is this like actual action figures from the 80s show, or are they like
They still make He-Man.
Right, but are these the same models as the ones from the 80s, or are they actually?
No, they're much awesomer. They're more articulated, better paint jobs.
How tall are they?
Nine. Let's see. They came today.
Oh.
Let's see. I got Scorpia today from the Princess of Power collection. Yeah. Well, that's part of the thing is that at this point they have the rights to do all the different figures that appeared on the show.
You know, it's funny. The thing is, Oracle.
I want to say close to like 7 inches, 8 inches. So they're pretty big.
I wonder how big Oracle would be then.
I have him somewhere. He's about, I want to say, 4 inches.
Okay. So I mean, I'm intrigued by this, you know, but I don't know. You know, I'm wondering about the, you know, businesses. I wonder if like small businesses, not big businesses, but, you know,
once it really infiltrates the market, I think it'll help smaller businesses because then there's no stopping what can be designed. And the buyer is the person who takes on the manufacturing cost.
Once kids figure out they can print their own Pokemon, it's all over.
No, once teenagers start printing penises, then you know it's all over.
Oh, this will revolutionize the sex toy industry.
I bet. Unfortunately, right now, with the home printer, only 4x...
Only 4 inches cube.
That's not exactly...
You just have to print 4 pieces and glue them together. Done.
That sounds like a piece is going to get broken off somewhere.
And
that just sounds
knows
like
you don't want you don't want the head to break off, you know. Okay, we're getting away from this as fast as possible. The next few news items are actually very new news items. We're going to go with the first one. Kinect Free Xbox One coming June 9th for $400. And this comes to us from Polygon. A Kinectless version of the Xbox One will be available on June 9th for $400. Microsoft has announced today. And by today, I mean today. The package will be available in, quote, all markets where the Xbox One is sold, said Phil Spencer, head of Xbox. For purchasers of the Kinect Free Xbox One, Microsoft will also offer a standalone Xbox One Kinect sensor as well. That's not the only change that Microsoft is doing for this June. Microsoft will also debut its Games with Gold program on Xbox One that same month. And I know Jordan's ears pricked up when he first learned of this. The company will also no longer require customers to have an Xbox Live Gold subscription in order to use non-gaming apps on the 360 and the Xbox One. According to Spencer, today's console announcement shouldn't be seen as a commentary on the Xbox One's Kinect's successor lack thereof, but also as a one way in which Microsoft is listening to the feedback from its consumers. Microsoft unveiled the Xbox One last May. The company's original plan was that the Kinect would be connected in order for the console to function. In other words, it couldn't work without it. That's back when it was supposed to be online, you know, all the time. Microsoft later eliminated that requirement while maintaining the viewpoint on the Kinect's importance. On other news, and this was actually like an hour ago, Microsoft also revealed they would be offering prorated refund for gamers unhappy with the Xbox Live changes. In other words, if you're using Xbox Live, not the game, but just to use Netflix and all that sort of stuff, you can cancel it now and get your money back prorated from the time that you didn't use. Okay, Jordan, go ahead.
This is pretty much everything that Microsoft should have done from the beginning. You know, I have complained vociferously over having to have Xbox Live for stuff that doesn't go through Xbox Live servers like Netflix and Internet Explorer and all of that other stuff.
I can tell you something, by the way. Netflix on the Xbox One is a whole lot better than Netflix on the PS4, PS3, and all that other stuff. I mean, there's so many things you can do with the Xbox One version of Netflix that you can't do with the others.
Well, I wouldn't know because we never hooked it up because I don't have gold. So we'll play with it. We'll play with it once we get things hooked up.
Hey, you get achievements for watching an entire season of a show.
Oh, nice. Well, that would be good.
Yeah.
But, you know,
that's bothersome.
Not if it's a show you like, Paul. It's not like they're going to force you to watch a show you don't want to watch.
We're catching up on Mad Men.
Well, here's a question for you. That's one. The other thing is I still haven't seen Orange is the New Black, so...
I haven't seen that either.
But that's because you both have no taste.
No, it's because we don't have any time. See, we have to pick our poisons here.
Yeah.
Well, when half the country's talking about it, you might want to pay attention.
Every hour spent watching Mad Men is an hour I could be gaming. So, but the flip side of this is that, you know, this is the latest example of the what fans, or I should say trolls, affectionately call the Xbox 180, right? Previously, Microsoft said that the Kinect was ingrained and vital, and you know originally the plan was that you couldn't even turn the Xbox One on if the Kinect wasn't connected, and now this is the final backtracking on all of that. We're not even going to make it a requirement.
I don't see it as backtracking. I mean, something backtracking is like Sony calling a Rumble last gen technology.
That's true too. But you know the stuff that Microsoft is doing with this particular generation of machine isn't really that much different from what Sony was dealing with on the PS3. I don't find it dissimilar.
What I think happened was that Microsoft tried to go two steps ahead and realized that they couldn't make that second step. Right. It wasn't a sin of omitting stuff, which Sony did with the PS3, or at least trying to. Well, actually, I mean, aside from the Blu-ray, but I'm saying, you know, Microsoft assumed that everybody wouldn't mind being online all the time, and you know, and having that connection and having all this stuff, you know. So they made a lot of assumptions. They tried to look like they were futuristic when people would have rather just took the one step, you know.
Well, people were telling them from the very beginning, no, this is a bad idea. We don't want this. We don't want this. We don't want this. And Microsoft doubled down at every stage until now they're finally having to reverse everything.
You know, I'm of mixed feelings about this. I definitely think that it's brilliant to, you know, finally not have an always on connection because, you know, quite frankly, that's just stupid.
Well, they didn't have it in the first place. They stopped that before it was actually released.
And you know, not charging people a separate additional fee to access Netflix on your machine when all of your competitors are offering it for free.
Oh, you know what? Here's something I just realized. You know what does have a separate subscription that Microsoft might want? MMOs. And this may be preparing for MMOs on the Xbox One and getting away from that complaint, not from the consumer, but from MMO companies who don't want to have that second charge. Anyways, move on.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But you know, I really am disappointed to hear that they're change. I'm not going to say backpedaling. I'm going to say they're deprioritizing their commitment to the Kinect. So now, like, as a designer, like, I would be less hesitant. You know, I would be more hesitant to, you know, get excited about any kind of content that would assume the Kinect was there.
But the problem,
whereas that could have been a really great option, and now it's just another sales barrier to any kind of feature that used the Kinect.
You know, the problem there, Paul, is that even when the Kinect was always there, developers weren't taking advantage of it anyway, so I don't think that's a problem. I mean, it would have been a problem.
Yeah, but
it wasn't that people didn't find it popular, it's just that no developers wanted to bother with it anyway.
To make it not included at this point is now to be like, yeah, developers, you were right. We don't really have any kind of ongoing commitment to our SKUs. And so I'm, you know, So but, you're right. There's never a reason to develop for any of our fancy hardware extensions because we're always going to abandon
them. But the thing is that, you know, the Xbox 360 Kinect sold extremely well, even though it wasn't included with every single Xbox 360. And they still had games made for it. It's just that the types of games that the Kinect does really well is actually for the family
part. They suck.
No, yeah. No.
And there were far fewer of them, which is the problem.
The kids' games that were done by Tim Schafer, for instance, were very popular. They have the Xbox One version of Kinectimals coming out. You know, so those are the sort of games that, you know, but when you tried to do a hardcore game like they did with Steel Battalion, then you ran into problems.
Failed miserably.
But if it's not supported, then there isn't going to be that kind of innovation or in using that hardware.
The Sports Rivals games also did very, very well, too, and they worked well as well. I mean, there will be still people trying to make trying to do some innovative stuff with it, you know. The thing that interests me is when Crysis decided to abandon the Kinect for their game Rise. Remember, Rise was supposed to be a Kinect first-person fighting game. People don't seem to remember that. And at some point, Crytek said, "We can't do this," and they turned it into Dynasty Warriors, you know. So,
well, the other part of it is, and I don't think it's necessarily the developers didn't want to support the Kinect. There are certain challenges that come with adding Kinect support. And the estimate I saw was basically you can add an extra 10% to your overhead if you want to support the Kinect. So that's really why you see developers walking away from it. And it's not because they don't want to do Kinect support. It's because they can't figure out how to do their game, plus take into account the extra resources involved to make the Kinect work.
At some point, you're going to have the Kinect game that's quote-unquote hardcore. I don't like using that term because it's stupid. But you're going to have that one game that incorporates Kinect that is just going to be, oh, wow, this is what it can really do, you know. They just haven't released that game yet, you know, except for kids. I mean, you know, the Happy Fun, what was it, Happy Time Theater? Or, you know, in which kids just screwed around and they played with bubbles on the screen and, you know, and all that stuff, you know, that they really had a lot of fun. It's not for us, it's for them, you know. And right now, you know, and the sports games, like I said, work really well. I mean, Nintendo proved that in the first place. I mean, with the Wiimote, I mean, that was the number one thing to use your Wiimote was with sports games.
Well, and you know, they've had two generations now to get a killer app out, and it hasn't happened. You know, I bought,
you know what the killer app is? The killer app is me telling my Xbox to turn on by itself and change channels without having to touch my remote and do all that stuff. The killer app is that it's a great interface tool.
The killer app is never going to be, I don't have to move my hands. That's not a killer app.
Are you kidding me? I am spoiled rotten by that. I'm sorry.
Nobody else is as lazy as you are, Jonah.
No, I mean, Arthur Geese on Rebel FM says the same thing. I mean, I just enjoy
the one thing that I do like about it is I can say Xbox turn off.
Yeah.
Yes. Have to have my screen on. So, you know, if I'm watching television and I forgot to turn the Xbox off, I can just say Xbox turn off. Yes, and it shuts itself down.
I will say this though, Paul, Jordan. Every so often, like once a week, you really want to go up to it and hold down the off button so that when it turns on, it clears its cache, because when it gets all unwieldy, it'll stop recognizing disks and all that stuff. So you really want to clear the cache every so often.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you use it as much as I do, but you know, you really, it doesn't really, I don't do it all the time because it takes longer to load after you tell it to clear the cache. But you want to do that every so often with everything, actually. I mean, with your computer and all that stuff. I'm just saying, you know, that's one option that you should, how you do it. And like I said, this is Xbox 101 right now. You put your you hold down the off button until it turns off, and, you know, for 20 to 30 seconds, you know, and then it'll turn off. And next time you turn it on, it'll clear the cache. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Who is this? I think it's me, right? Philip sues Nintendo, seeks halt to Wii U sales in the U.S. And this comes just from Game Informer. Philips has filed suit against Nintendo claiming patent infringement. Specifically, the complaint focuses on the motion-controlled consoles and peripherals, including the Wii U and its accessories and technology that, quote, models a user's body in a virtual environment by animating a virtual body to follow the physical movements of the user. The suit was filed on May 14th in Delaware. That's today, by the way. And claims infringement of Philips's world body virtual body control device and user interface system based on a pointy device patents. Philips also claims Nintendo was aware of its patents via correspondence dated December 2011. Philips seeks damages for the infringement and enhancement of valued at three times that, as well as interest. The company also seeks an injunction against further importation and sales of the Wii U and infringing products. Now, the thing that makes this one different than the patent squatters, you know, those patent squatters who just come up with patents for everything and then try to sue and hope they win, is that, one, Philips is kind of a major company here, right? And two, if they have correspondence with Nintendo, which acknowledged it, you know, then that's something serious.
But it didn't say that that Nintendo acknowledged the legitimacy of their patents. It said that they sent them a letter. They said that they sent them a letter.
Okay. How about you? I
think it's silly because neither the Wii nor the Wii U models a user's body. So initially from the get-go, it's invalid.
Bigger concern,
why now? Why not in 2007 when the Wii was exploding everywhere?
Well, actually, right. I think Nintendo was coming up with something new. Remember, they've been talking about for the past 2 years this new technology that would be with the balance board that could scan your body and stuff like that. So I think that's maybe what they're talking about. This is not Paul. What's it called? The Wii U came out a year and a half ago. This is not, you know, I mean.
But it says that this was for the Wii. But it says it's the same technology. A user interface system based on pointing device. Does that not sound like the Wii?
Well, that's the Wiimote, but it's something different concerning technology. I just think they're talking about that.
But it's the same remote.
No, they're talking about. But the thing is, they're talking about that body scanner, or whatever that's supposed to be on the next
models a user body in a virtual environment by animating a virtual body to follow the physical movements of the user. Neither the Wii nor the Wii U does that.
No, actually, the balance board was supposed to be doing that for the Wii U.
No, they both do that. When you point the Wii when you point the remote at the screen, there's a little hand there as your pointer, just like there would be on a computer.
Yes, but it's
so technically
tracking,
they both do that.
It sounds more like the Kinect.
It sounds more like the Kinect. It's tracking what the Wii and Wii U do is they track the controller. They don't track the user's body. And there's no mapping of the human body. Even in stuff like Just Dance, it's following the nunchuck and the remote. It's not tracking the user's body. Now, stuff like the Kinect absolutely does model the human body. So
why aren't they going after Kinect?
My question. The thing is that, why are they going up after
Well, they can't
Nintendo?
Go after Kinect because, remember, Microsoft bought the technology. Well, not actually rented out the technology from PrimeSense. They're the ones who invented the technology. So if anybody's going
bullshit
after anybody, they're going to be going after PrimeSense. They're the ones who did it. Microsoft was using the technology to make the Kinect. You know, so.
Nope, I call bullshit. Bullshit on the whole thing.
And this may sound like a slam, but if they do halt Wii U sales in the U.S., is anybody going to notice?
Oh, crickets.
Oh, burn.
Crickets. Crickets. Crickets.
Anyways, we were going to do a gaming history, but this episode has run long, so we're going to do it next week.
I don't want to really read the Nolan Bushnell thing again. I've read it like three times already.
Spoiler. Actually, you know what I can do? Let me see if I can just
care enough about it to sit through him reading it again.
Well, the thing is, I think I still have that in my thing, so maybe I'll cut and paste it. But
I hope so, because I really don't want to read all that again.
Well, without reading the thing, just say what you thought of Nolan Bushnell then.
Nolan Bushnell was a giant in the industry. We wouldn't have modern gaming as we know it today without his contribution. And Chuck E. Cheese is a mean video game crack habit animatronic robot mouse thing.
I don't have Chuck E. Cheese, but we do have Dave and Buster's, which stole the concept. You know, you pay.
Well, yes, except that they don't have animatronic.
No, they don't have animatronic rats. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. So, anyways, fortunately, this podcast went really well, and you know,
it didn't die one time. It didn't die a single time tonight. I'm so excited.
You know what? I think it's because of my brand new spiffy 5G wireless modem.
I think it probably is. Anyway, and we kept telling you as it was dying, it was all your fault. And you
It was the like I said, Time Warner was going nuts, or they actually used Roadrunner. So, but
wow, Roadrunner's still in business.
Well, Time Warner ate them, at least in New York. Okay, now we're going to get into gaming history. Take it away, Jordan.
Gaming history. Nolan Bushnell. Nolan Key Bushnell was born February 5th, 1943, and is an American engineer and entrepreneur who founded both Atari Incorporated and the Chuck E. Cheese Pizza Time Theaters chain. In 1969, Bushnell and colleague Ted Dabney formed Syzygy. I thought I said
There's far too many Y's in that word.
Syzygy.
You know, by the way,
that's not natural. That looks like an English abortion.
You know, Paul, notice that I gave you the very easy name of Andrew Wilson.
Yeah, you got to play to the strengths of your team, Jonah.
Yep.
In 1969, Bushnell and colleague Ted Dabney formed Syzygy with the intention of producing a space war clone known as Computer Space. In order to keep the company alive while the machine was being prototyped, the two took on a route servicing broken pinball machines. Dabney built the prototype and Bushnell shopped it around looking for a manufacturer. They made an agreement with Nutting Associates. I just like saying Nutting Associates.
That sounds like Paul's porn company.
Speaking of the adult toy industry.
A maker of coin-op trivia and shooting games, who produced a fiberglass cabinet for the unit that included a coin slot mechanism.
Yeah, this thing that they, by the way, they have the picture there. This does not look like an arcade cabinet.
It looks like the
most horrible part of Star Wars.
It looks like something from Doctor Who.
It's a giant-sized rabbit vibrator is what it is.
Okay, this podcast has also gotten very blue.
It's what people in the 40s thought the 1980s would look like.
Exactly, yes. Computer Space was a commercial failure, though. Sales exceeded $3 million. Bushnell felt that Nutting Associates had not marketed the game well and decided that his next game would be licensed to a bigger manufacturer. In 1972, Bushnell and Dabney set off on their own and learned that the name Syzygy was in use. Really?
It is an actual word, though.
Yes. Bushnell has said at different times that it was in use by a candle company owned by a Mendocino hippie commune and by a roofing company.
Neither one of those things would be competition because this makes video games, but whatever.
Syzygy. They incorporated under the name Atari, a reference to a check-like position in a game of Go, which Bushnell has called his favorite game of all time.
Let me ask you a question. Are either of you Go fans?
No.
No.
I looked at it and no. Okay. No.
But it's a fellow for smart people.
After Bushnell attended a Burlingame, California demonstration of the Magnavox Odyssey, he gave the task of making the Magnavox tennis game into a coin-op version to Alcom as a test project. Alcom incorporated many of his own improvements.
Alcorn, just so you know.
Is it Alcorn?
It's Alcorn.
Let me try that again. After Bushnell attended a Burlingame, California demonstration of the Magnavox Odyssey, he gave the task of making the Magnavox tennis game into a coin-op version to Alcorn as a test project. Alcorn incorporated many of its own improvements into the game design, such as scoring and sound, and Pong was born. Pong proved to be very popular. Atari released a large number of Pong-based arcade games over the next few years as the mainstay of the company. Using borrowed parts from Atari, having the main PCB printed up by Atari employee Howard Canton, and receiving further assistance from Atari employee Ron Wayne, two non-employees, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, both of whom had previously been involved in the development of the Atari game Breakout, created and marketed their own home computer. They offered the design to Bushnell, but Atari had no desire to build computers at the time, instead focusing on the arcade and home console markets. By 1976, Atari was in the midst of developing the Atari VCS video computer system, later renamed the Atari 2600. But Bushnell realized if the company was going to grow, it needed capital, and with the stock market in a bleak condition, going public would not be the solution. He made a list of companies to approach to buy Atari. Meanwhile, Steve Ross, CEO of Warner Communications, noticed that his children were hovering around video game cabinets at Walt Disney World. Warner Communications was contacted about Atari by one of its investors to discuss purchasing the company. For $28 million, Warner Communications, now Time Warner, bought Atari, bringing the capital they needed for the VCS launch, which took place in August of 1977. In November of 1978, Bushnell was forced out of the company after a dispute with Warner over its future direction, notably on the lifespan of the Atari 2600 and their closed software strategy, which was later changed for the new home computer division.
And by the way, that closed software strategy, once Activision popped around, that burst like a very weak bubble.
Yeah, Activision was huge. In 1977, while at Atari, Bushnell purchased Pizza Time Theater from Warner Communications. It had been created by Bushnell originally as a place where kids could go to eat pizza and play video games, which would therefore function as a distribution channel for Atari games. The Pizza Time Theater / Chuck E. Cheese also had animatronic animals that played music as entertainment. Bushnell had always wanted to work for Walt Disney, but was continually turned down for employment when he was first starting out after graduation. Chuck E. Cheese was his homage to Disney and the technology developed there. In 1981, Bushnell turned over day-to-day food operations of Chuck E. Cheese to a newly hired restaurant executive. Bushnell's most recent company is Brain Rush, where he is founder, CEO, and chairman, a company that uses video game technology and educational software. The company was venture capital funded in 2012. It is based on the idea that many curriculum lessons can be turned into mini games. Between 2010 and 2012, Brain Rush ran a test in Spanish language vocabulary learning with over 2,200 teachers and 80,000 students across the country and got an increase in learning speed between 8 to 10 times over traditional learning. Bushnell has been inducted into the Video Game Hall of Fame and the Consumer Electronics Association Hall of Fame, received the BAFTA Fellowship and the nation's Restaurant News Innovator of the Year Award, and was named one of Newsweek's 50 Men Who Changed America. Bushnell has started more than 20 companies and is one of the founding fathers of the video game industry. Nolan is credited with Bushnell's Law, an aphorism about games, quote, easy to learn and difficult to master, being rewarding.
Yeah. So, well,
I agree.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, Paul, how much do you follow that law?
I mean, that's one of the rules of good game design.
Yeah. You know, there's another saying that was done by Jack Nicklaus, who designed golf courses, and his thing was make it look hard, but play easy. Make it look harder than it is, and that also is rewarding. When something looks really, really difficult, but it's actually easier than people think it is, people feel like they accomplished something, even if it wasn't taking a lot of energy. So they feel, you know, empowered. So, you know, I mean, add those two together, and you have civilization, actually.
Tetris.
What?
Tetris.
Oh, yeah, Tetris. There you go. You know, the funny thing is, and I don't know if I should be ashamed to say this, but I've never been inside a Chuck E. Cheese. So... anyways, thanks for listening in. We will see you next week. Hope you enjoyed this this milestone episode, which we didn't really treat like a milestone episode. We have a question of the week, and it is tied with Nolan Bushnell. What is your favorite educational video game? And I'm not gonna spoil because we already know the answers from last week. But go ahead, Jordan.
My favorite educational video game is clearly Carmen Sandiego. You know, a huge IP. It was a fantastic game.
It was an awesome cartoon.
It was an awesome cartoon.
Was it? I know that Lynn Thigpen was live action in it, though.
I think that's correct.
As was Rockabella.
You know, the fantastic theme song and all of that stuff. I loved playing that game, even though I was an adult and knew my geography. I would have loved to have seen a variation of the game. Woody Allen wrote a story called the Kugelmass episode about a guy who invents a device that lets him step into the page of any novel. They should have done something like that with Carmen Sandiego, where she escapes into the pages of a book.
I was so excited when I first saw the original trailer for Despicable Me, because I could have sworn they had made a Carmen Sandiego movie. I almost wet myself.
Yep.
Which begs the question why they haven't made a movie, you know?
I don't know. I really, if they do, I hope they go with the character design from the cartoon, because that was awesome. She had that giant trench coat and the fedora.
I think we have to wait another 5 or 10 years for the nostalgia factor to kick in.
As for me, mine was the original Oregon Trail. You know,
you have died of dysentery.
You bastard. I was about to say that. I can't imagine. I can't tell you how many people died of dysentery on my friggin'. I did manage to make it to Oregon fairly regularly, though, by the way.
You think that's bad? Try having to be the teacher that has to explain to kids what dysentery means. Ugh.
One of my coworkers came out here from Washington, D.C., and he and his wife both managed to get dysentery on the Oregon Trail. And they survived. They made it. They're here.
That's disgusting.
Just getting mauled by a grizzly bear, you know. How about you, Paul?
You know, I gotta say, it's a tie between Mario Teaches Typing.
Yeah.
And the Cave of the Word Wizard, because the Word Wizard was a spelling game, and you had to basically find your way out before the flashlight batteries died. And every once in a while, this creepy ass looking wizard would appear. Oh my god, it was fucking terrifying.
A wizard.
The wizard would just appear, and he would ask you to spell a word that he'd never taught you how to spell. But the game would speak to you so that you couldn't cheat and copy it off of the screen. My mother thought she was being so slick.
You know,
so it would be like, spell aardvark. I'm like, I don't even know what that is.
A-A-R-D-V-A-R-K. So there. On that note, I also still have on my computer Typing of the Dead. So
Typing of the
Which
Dead.
Which is really
awesome.
Hilarious, because if you play the light gun game, you know, they're armed with guns. But when you play Typing of the Dead, they have these weird packs, and slung over their shoulders is a keyboard, so that they actually are typing out these words to kill the undead.
Well, now, that's special.
Now, where does something like Mavis Beacon fall in that? Is that more before. Educational See, than games,
Mavis,
or?
Well, Mavis Beacon came before, right?
Right.
And Typing of the Dead was actually a riff on Mavis Beacon.
Right, exactly.
You know, and it was a game, though.
And that was my question. Do we consider Mavis Beacon a game, or is it more of an educational title itself?
It's an educational title that made it a little gamey, because it would put scores, if I remember correctly.
Right.
You know, and then someone had the bright idea. Hey, let's turn this into the Typing of the Dead.
Well, it was House of the Dead first on the Dreamcast. And then what they did is they took the House of the Dead game, took out the light gun, and replaced it with a keyboard.
So anyways, look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. If you enjoy feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at gamingpodcast.net. I'll set us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast.net or the forums at gamingpodcast.net/forum. Or send your comments to fans@gamingpodcast.net. You can also check out our gaming news and games news comments, and subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us some iTunes comments. And I see the Pinsanity is no longer around. Are we no longer Pinsane?
Oh, no, we are. We just don't need to, you know, call it new every time anymore.
Yeah, well, check out Pinsanity. Oh, gee, I forgot the name. Not Pinsanity, but what was it?
Team USA's Pinsanity. Team USA Pinsanity,
right. So, anyways, we will see you next week. And by the way, this is our new recording time. We're now recording on Wednesdays to accommodate Paul here.
Woohoo, Wednesdays.
Yay, Paul.
Yay, Paul.
You remind me of those two guys, those two kids in Psychonauts, the cheerleaders, who are always dancing going, yay, Raz, yay, Raz. Anyway.
And I don't have to rush to go watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Okay. I've got plenty of time before Arrow starts.
See,
so
it just
good.
Works out better for everyone.
Yep.
Anyways, we will see you next week.
Good night, everybody.
Bye, Bonds.